So why don't we start with introductions? You want to just tell us who you are?
I'm Gray Ribka. I'm at the University of Washington. I'm a professor here in the Department of Physics.
So we're in a big sort of a warehousey space with lots of cool-looking machines, pretty evocative. There's a sign right next to us that says Caution Radiation Area. I just noticed that. But over here, there's a big, shiny metal cylinder, copper on the bottom, what looks like steel maybe on the top. What is that thing?
So that's an experiment called ADMX, and it's looking for dark matter.
Gray Ribka, what is dark matter?
So the stuff that makes up you and me and the planet we're standing on and everything we know, atoms and light, we think we understand that pretty well. But when we look up to the sky, we see that there seems to be a lot of stuff out there that's gravitationally attracting that's not made of atoms. The leading theory is that there's all this extra stuff out there that's made of something different, something that's not emitting light, and so we call it dark matter.
How much stuff are we talking about?
Oh, 4 or 5 times what there is in normal matter, so it's a lot. It's not just a little bit.
So I should mention, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. The theme for today's show is invisible, and dark matter seems like it's even more invisible than the usual sense of the word. Why can't we see dark matter?
Well, from what we can tell, it doesn't seem to interact with light.
So normally we see things or detect things by light or something else bouncing off of it, right? And so you're saying that dark matter, things don't bounce off of dark matter?
Right. Everything seems to just pass through it. Or maybe more appropriately, it passes through everything.
Wait, what do you mean by that? Like, where is it?
There's probably this uniform density of dark matter around us. It's about 1 proton's worth per cubic centimeter.
What about the cubic centimeters between you and I right now?
Yeah, there's going to be dark matter between you and I. There's going to be dark matter in your closet, under your bed, dark matter between the stars.
Why do you care about finding it?
Well, it's interesting to me because from what we can tell, it is so very different from all the other particles we know. We have this thing called the Standard Model that seems to explain pretty well electrons, protons, neutrons, things that make up atoms, explains light. And yet here's this stuff out there that doesn't fit. It doesn't fit at all with the Standard Model, and so it's something completely new and different. I guess it's the new and different that excites me. It's completely outside of our understanding.
Well, one of the most invisible things in the universe, we think, seemed like a pretty good way to get underway here on Sound Effect from KPLU. Stories of things unseen coming up on the show, so don't go away. Danny Dover is a Seattle author and tech entrepreneur, and about 5 years ago, he was going through depression. And he didn't want to take pills or go into therapy, so he started asking people he knew about what experiences gave them a deep sense of fulfillment or satisfaction. And then he took a bunch of those experiences and he plowed them into this big old bucket list. Now, a lot of these were really big and showy, you know, things like visiting every continent or climbing Mount Rainier or flying an airplane. But this one experience intrigued him that required making himself completely invisible. Danny Dover wanted to learn how to be a pickpocket. He got the idea from somebody else's story.
With this particular instance, the person talked about a trip that had been going really, really well. It was in Barcelona, but they got pickpocketed. And this would normally have ruined the trip for them, but for whatever reason, they spent the rest of the time trying to get that guy back. This person claims that they were able to pickpocket the person who had pickpocketed them. I don't know if I really believe that, but I do like the story a lot. So I wanted to see if I could bring that aspect into my life. So I added become a pickpocket to my bucket list, to my life list.
What appealed to you about it, though?
It was a skill that I admired as far as sleight of hand. Like, I like seeing magicians do that kind of thing, and I'm always impressed by it. But it was something that was so anti who I am, and it was something that just seemed so daring and out of character for me that I immediately jumped on it.
Oh, that's interesting. Like, I've occasionally fantasized about, like, learning how to box, because it's the most out of character thing I can imagine. And this felt like that to you?
For sure. That's actually one of the things I like most about this life list, is because I'm using other people's stories and experiencing that myself, I find a lot of interest, like boxing, that I never would have known that I had if I wouldn't have just jumped in and started to do it.
So how do you go about doing that? I mean, can you like email somebody and say, hey, can I come watch you rob people?
Not successfully. I mean, I did try reaching out to people, but inherent to this task, to pickpocketing, they don't want to be recognized. They don't want to teach anyone. It's kind of like Fight Club in that way. So once I failed there, I kind of came up with the idea, well, if I'm going to learn how to do this and I can't find resources elsewhere, I'm going to have to just study how other people do it. I would schedule time on my calendar to go to places where there are pickpocketers, where I knew I'd find them. So the Louvre is a great example of this. different places around Rome, different places around Barcelona, different places around just other major cities in the world.
Okay, so set the scene for us in one of these places. Where are you, where are they, and what are you seeing?
We'll take Barcelona. There's a street called Las Ramblas, which is very known for pickpockets and for tourists who are looking to go to clubs and to eat at kind of touristy restaurants. And I eventually just sat down at a cafe and was just sipping coffee, kind of as the locals do, and just watching people watching. And that's when I spotted different pickpocketers. What I eventually learned through this is that a lot of pickpocketing is not so much the sleight of hand or the technique itself. It's more understanding how society governs body language and personal space and these kind of subtle cultural rules, and then figuring out how you can influence that or how you can manipulate it. So a major part of being a pickpocketer is that you become what's called gray man. And gray man is a concept. It's not a man or a woman. It's a person who just blends in.
This is a person who's invisible.
It's a person who's invisible. That's right.
How do you do that?
Well, you do it by becoming as little of a threat as humanly possible. So you are wearing the same clothes as the locals. You're walking at the same pace. You're using the same kind of movements as you walk. Like in Spain, for example, they walk a little bit slower and they walk a little bit longer. Then from there, you got to dress the part. So you need to, if they're wearing more loose clothing or if they're wearing certain brands, you got to start playing that part. And then you need to do the opposite of being a social person, which is avoiding eye contact and keeping your voice low without being shady. And you need to stay out of people's personal bubbles to begin with because you don't want to threaten anyone or be intrusive. And you need to kind of just go with the flow. You know, again, you need to be gray man. You need to not be visible. You need to be invisible.
So once you are able to then insinuate yourself into somebody's space, you get close enough to actually be able to physically reach into their pocket or their handbag or whatever. Well, what do you do? Like, I've never been pickpocketed, and it's hard for me to imagine having somebody pull the wallet out of my pocket without me noticing.
A mix of sleight of hand and just understanding these weird societal rules about body language and comfort levels. I tried it in lots of cities around the world, and I couldn't do it. It was very scary. And this is why it took me so long to learn, not because any of the techniques are particularly difficult. Unzipping something is not a hard task to accomplish. But it was such an important part of me, and I think an important part of a lot of people, to not steal and to be afraid of that situation.
So the biggest challenge in some ways was overcoming your deep-seated morals and conscience.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's very much it's much more of an internal battle than it is an external battle.
And that seemed like a good idea to you, though, still.
It's something I did. I don't know if it was a good idea, but it was something that I was pursuing.
So did you ever succeed?
I did. I did succeed. I was actually in Seattle, and I happened to be at Freak Night. So it's a big party that they have in downtown Seattle. And I spotted a guy who's dressed up like a tacky tourist. And this opportunity was just perfect because these were exactly the kind of people that I had watched get pickpocketed with this guy that I...
Oh, wait. So this was like a costumey kind of a
scenario.
It's a costume.
It's a dress-up party.
And this guy was dressed up as like the classic Mark.
Exactly right. Yeah. So he had a fanny pack. He had a Hawaiian shirt on. I think he had an expensive-looking camera around his neck. He just had all of these signs of a tacky tourist. So I waited for the moment that was right, which for me was just me finally having the guts to go and try to do it. I bumped into the guy with his shoulder at the same time with my right hand, which is my dominant hand. I unzipped the fanny pack, which is backwards to the pickpocketer. So you need to keep that in mind.
I see. So you had to reach around a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So I'm standing in front of him, but come at him about a 45 degree angle.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And so how quick did all this happen?
Very fast. It'll take me much longer to explain the process than it actually did. So I unzip it with one hand, my dominant hand. I then use my other hand with my left hand to grab what was ever in it. At the same time, I'm hitting the guy on the shoulder after I've switched hands and saying, "Hey, man, sorry, I didn't mean to do that." Making eye contact with him, touching him. So all of his senses are then directed to his shoulder where I'm touching him. Then I grabbed the object, put it in my back pocket so that if he looked down at me, he wouldn't see anything. And then I kind of slowly moved away, again, reassuring the guy, "Hey, sorry that happened."
Huh. So what did you wind up with? What was in your pocket?
So I backed away to make sure that I was clear. I checked what I got. It was the guy's wallet. I had a bunch of cash in it. I had a bunch of credit cards. I then did the second part, which planned all along. I went back to the guy and I gave him his wallet back. And it was actually kind of a funny interaction. I tapped him on the shoulder again. I said, "Hey, you dropped this." And he was in party mode. So he's like, "Hey, bro, thanks so much. Can I give you a reward or something?" And I was like, "No, that's completely unnecessary. Oh, thanks, man."
If you only knew. Yeah. So all along, you had planned to return what you stolen. You never planned to actually keep this stuff.
Absolutely. So it was important to me not to actually steal. That's not something that I want to do. I don't find any value in that. But I wanted to make sure that I actually had the guts to go through and do this, interact with someone like that.
So can I play devil's advocate about the list for a second?
Sure.
So if you just glance at the list, I mean, besides the pickpocketing is a little bit of an outlier. A lot of it is stuff that's like world travel and flying planes and driving race cars and stuff like that. It could look like a rich kid's to-do list.
Yes.
So is there anything redeeming, socially redeeming about it?
I think that when I first started, it was solely for me. I knew I wanted to become a better writer, and I knew that I wanted to share these experiences that I was doing with other people. But as I did that, and as I started interacting with more people, this has become less of a mission for myself. I'm about to finish it. I started with 150 items. I have 10 left, and I have a deadline that's 2 years away, so 10 items in 2 years is very doable. So now I'm starting to shift gears, and this is one of my major learnings, that my world's become a lot less about me and a lot more about other people.
All right, well, Danny Dover is a Seattle-based author and a blogger about his life list. And one of the items on that list is learning to become a pickpocket. So thank you so much for telling us about your experience here on Sound Effect.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today, we're telling tales of the unseen. So there are illnesses that you can see, and then there are ones that are invisible, where the person looks completely healthy on the outside. There's a family of conditions like that where the person gets horrible cramps and has to go to the bathroom like a dozen times a day. Trying to explain all those trips to the toilet can be pretty awkward, especially for a kid, or worse yet, for an adolescent when everything's awkward. But that is what it's like for a lot of kids struggling with Crohn's and colitis. More than a million people are thought to have those conditions in the U.S., and about 10% of them are children. So as you can imagine, most of those kids try and keep their illness invisible. But there is a place where for a week out of the year, everything's out in the open and no explanations are necessary. KPLU's Jennifer Wing has the story.
Camp Coleman is a YMCA camp on Washington's Key Peninsula. It's the southern end of Puget Sound. It's surrounded by water. Wooded hills make up the terrain. It's noon, and the cafeteria is crowded with kids ages 6 to 17 wearing t-shirts and shorts. Announcements are made. There's a dance coming up, the Dork Dance. Kids write down the songs they want to hear on a big sheet of paper taped to a window.
Over here on the window, we have the sign up for the Dork Dance, songs that you would like to hear. Let's keep that to two per cabin, please, or two or three per cabin. And don't forget your lunch meds. Go.
Lunch meds, a 24-hour medical team, extra portable bathrooms dotted around the property. These are the small reminders that this is not an ordinary overnight camp. For 1 week out of the year, Camp Coleman turns into Camp Oasis. Kathleen Newbolt, the regional education and support manager for the Northwest Crohn's and Colitis chapter, says this is where kids from Idaho, Alaska, Wyoming, Washington, and Oregon can let their illnesses that they try to keep invisible most of the year just not be an issue.
There's not a direct, we're all going to sit around the campfire and talk about our colons. It's not that kind of thing.
But some colon talk does happen. Six of the campers have a type of ostomy. Waste from the intestine empties out at the stomach into a bag. One night, these campers gathered in the common room to meet other kids who have the daily responsibility of managing this medical gear. It was a little slow to start.
They weren't sure what to say, and somebody said, "What kind of ostomy do you have?" And they said, "Oh, I have an ileostomy, and I have a colostomy, and what kind of supplies do you keep on hand, and what sorts of wafers and attachments do you use?" And it was great. They stayed in here for an hour, and somebody asked if they could do it again.
Fiona has been coming to Camp Oasis every summer since she was six. She has Crohn's. She's dealing with a recent flare-up and isn't able to eat any solid food right now. She's getting all of her nutrition from a liquid supplement that goes into her body, from a tube that goes directly into her stomach.
I've had around like 5 to 6 surgeries already. It can be hard at first, but I think once you overcome the pain, it helps.
The surgeries removed feet of intestine that became scarred from too much inflammation. Many of the kids at Camp Oasis have had these sorts of operations. Fiona is 16, but could easily pass for a healthy 12-year-old. Kathleen Newbold says this is completely normal.
But a lot of kids, they're not absorbing nutrients as much as other kids do. And so it's something that we warn the counselors about is don't guess a kid's age because you're going to guess it wrong. They look younger than they are.
Looking at Fiona, you wouldn't know that sometimes she has pain that feels like she ate crushed glass, or that on a bad day, she has bloody diarrhea and has to make multiple trips to the bathroom. Explaining her needs at school can be hard.
Definitely like teachers. I've had to go to the bathroom and they say, you know, oh, you're not allowed to, or, you know, you have to stay more minutes, and then, you know, I'll say, oh, I really have to go, you know, or if I have to go to the nurse's office, they'll ask, you know, why do you have to go? You know, I just want to go.
The exact causes of Crohn's and colitis are unknown. According to the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, genetics play a role. Certain foods can be triggers. Back in the cafeteria, the head nurse, Teresa Lux, is handing out medication and checking in with the campers.
That's the vitamin that's going to make the afternoon.
Lux works in the gastrointestinal department at Seattle's Children's Hospital.
So what's been the best part of camp?
Paddleboarding.
Oh, you want paddleboarding?
Yeah.
I see our kids struggling with a disease that people don't want to talk about because you don't want to talk about your private bathroom business. And so they can be very isolated. You can't tell that anyone's ill, so you don't know all the pain and things that they feel. I see our kids come to camp and see how they blossom. Over the years, I've seen hundreds of kids that it's made such a difference in their life, giving them such self-confidence. And they hear about other kids' stories and they think, oh, gosh, he has a letter jacket. He plays high school sports. I can do that.
Throughout the week, campers have that thought a lot. I can do that. They hone their archery skills.
All right, let's bring that bow arm up. Face it straight down at the target. You may fire when ready.
Almost got two apples.
Good job.
And there's a climbing wall that's about 3 stories high. You have to wear a harness. People on the ground spot you with ropes. When campers make it to the top, they ring a bell.
All right, you ready to come down?
Coming back down can be harder than going up.
Can you put your feet straight out in front of you?
Can we try going down a little slower than we have been the last few times?
Yes.
And like a typical camp, the older kids are training to become counselors. This is what Gil is doing. He's 17. His Crohn's is in remission. He follows a strict diet to keep it in check. He's a role model for the younger campers.
The condition in and of itself, I mean, it's talking about your GI tract. And so you answer questions every doctor's visit about how you poop, which isn't necessarily something that a lot of kids, you know, especially like at this age, are necessarily super comfortable with talking about openly. But it's actually been a great way for me to sort of get past, I think, that sort of typical teenage cool barrier that you have. Like, there are certain things that are taboo to talk about when you're a teenager. And also, so like with my daily routine, I'm cooking almost everything that I eat. And that's actually really empowering because I'm confident now that when I go out into the world, when I'm independent, when I'm in college, when I have, you know, living out on my own, doing a job, it becomes a sense of empowerment. It's how I become independent.
Being in a safe place with other kids who face the same challenges makes these campers feel normal. For Fiona, it's 7 days free from shame.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you're not embarrassed to go to the bathroom, really. And you're not embarrassed to, like, you know, if you have a G-tube or you have a feeding, you're not like, oh, I have to cover it or anything, you know. It's like all fine and everything, and everyone understands, so it's all good.
At the end of the week, kids will be leaving with the contact info for new friends who live in different states. Kathleen Newbold says it's not unusual for campers to see a familiar face from their school show up at camp.
They didn't know that that other kid had Crohn's or colitis.
These kids might not end up becoming best friends, but when they're back out in the real world and they pass each other in the hallway, they know they'll have a secret ally who understands.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. And as we talk about invisibility today, we thought we would invite our resident librarian to come and join us and point out a few of the places that this seems to bubble up in books by Northwest authors. And so I welcome once again Amber Slavin, who's a librarian at the King County Library System. Hey, Slavin.
Hi, Gabe. How are you?
I'm really good. And we've been having a lot of fun thinking about invisibility, things that are unseen. And I get the sense that your imagination kind of took off when you were thinking about how this pops up in books.
It certainly did. And I felt immediately I thought of some titles that might work and admittedly maybe made them work the way I wanted them to.
That's the idea. All right. So what was the first book that came to mind?
Me and My Daddy Listened to Bob Marley by Ann Pancake, who is an amazing author originally from Appalachia. I think she was born in West Virginia. She talks a lot about kind of people's intense connection to the land and writes stories about coal mining, fracking, that sort of thing, and also ghosts and bones and just haunting topics with really haunting imagery and really kind of dense poetic language, and sort of ties that to the unseen toll that takes on people's mental wellness and their psyche.
Oh, yeah. So you can kind of imagine some of the scars that are invisible above the land when you're thinking about things like strip mining or coal mining or fracking or something like that. And I'm guessing that has parallels then to the human beings in the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what in this book resonated with you then?
I had recently come across this project, this photo project in the New York Times Lens blog, which is their photo blog, called Looking at Appalachia, and sort of their mission is to show photography that gives a picture of non-stereotypical things in Appalachia, sort of the unseen Appalachia. And I picked up this book around the same time, and I just felt like they really kind of locked together and were really great in tandem. And some of the photos and some of the stories are actually kind of hard to look at for a lot of reasons. They're just painful or so tender, it's a little hard to look at, but they also are sometimes revealing things that are kind of stereotypes, and then you have to think about, well, what do those stereotypes actually mean? And it was an uncomfortable book in a lot of ways.
And that's an endorsement from Slavin, right?
That's absolutely an endorsement. All the books I picked for today, I've realized were kind of anti-summer reads. So.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, let's move on with the discomfort. Well, that book is called Me and My Daddy Listen to Bob Marley by Ann Pancake, who teaches at Pacific Lutheran University, it so happens. All right, what do we have next?
My Body is a Book of Rules by Alyssa Washuta.
All right, well, tell us about that. Who is Alyssa Washuta?
Alyssa Washuta is an amazing young writer who's based out of the Pacific Northwest. I think she lives in Seattle, does some work with the Department of American Indian Studies at UW at the University of Washington. And this is her biography. She's a young woman, but has so much life experience to write about. It's sort of a coming-of-age, fast-paced, memoir-type book about her struggling with her identity as someone who's a member of the Cowlitz Indian tribe. And then she also has bipolar disorder. So I thought a lot about how those sometimes sort of invisible things intersect and affect her life.
You said this was non-linear, right? Or non-chronological, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, each chapter, the format is a little bit different, and it's definitely not chronological. It's not a linear book at all.
Is it disorienting to read?
Yes, but it's super compelling. It's not an easy read. It's kind of harsh, but it's hard to put down, and it's really engaging. I think a direct quote is, she says, "I look white. You might think that means I'm white, but I'm not." So she also kind of struggles with the privilege and the burden of being a white-appearing Native American person.
Oh, wow. So the elements of her identity are also kind of invisible unless she chooses to reveal them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, struggling with mental illness, sometimes it's very visible if you're a person who's crying or trying to physically harm yourself or, you know, manic, whatever. But oftentimes mental illness is also very unseen.
Well, that book is called My Body is a Book of Rules by Alyssa Washuta. And finally, we have another book, a very different book from the memoir and the collection of short stories that we've mentioned so far.
That's right. This is Kindred by Octavia Butler.
Now, I have to say, since you're from Ohio, mm-hmm. most people would call this Kindred.
Well, I did say Appalachia earlier instead of Appalachia, which is the correct way, my way. But
so Octavia Butler, who's no longer with us, but she's like a sci-fi author, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And she's not a Pacific Northwest author per se, but she did spend her last years living in the Seattle area. I think Lake Forest Park, actually.
Totally counts.
Yeah, good. That's great.
So is this a sci-fi book?
It's definitely sci-fi. I kind of consider it sort of an entry, a gateway sci-fi book in a lot of ways. I'm not a big science fiction fan, but the portrayals of life in the different times are very realistic. So it's very straightforward until you kind of get to the time travel part. So wait,
there's time travel.
There is time travel. There's non-consensual time travel.
Not so she doesn't have control, or the protagonist doesn't have control over when and where she gets zapped to?
That's right. So the protagonist, a woman named Dana, is living in the late 70s, I think, in LA. And sometimes she's just zapped back to slavery times in Maryland to a plantation. And her husband in the present actually sees her disappear. She suddenly becomes invisible, and then minutes later will come back after sometimes spending days or months or years back in the South.
So now, Octavia Butler was African-American. Is the protagonist also African-American?
That's right. And so aside from the obvious, this character actually disappearing and being invisible suddenly, Octavia Butler talked in interviews about how she didn't see herself in science fiction, and she chose to write herself in and become visible.
And this, if this is an African American character traveling back in time to slavery times, I'm guessing there's an element of social commentary there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dana, as an African American woman herself, has to look at slavery in a way that she's only read about or kind of heard about, and certainly felt in historical ways, but never had to actually see and feel it.
Is it a weird book?
Yes, it is a weird book, but there is tons of dialogue in this book, so it reads really quickly. It's a real page-turner, and I think that the dialogue helps it feel a little less weird.
All right. Well, the book is called Kindred, or Kindred, depending on how you say that, by Octavia Butler, and we are going to list all of Slavin's recommendations on our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Amber Slavin is a librarian at the Burien branch of the King County Library System. Thanks for coming back on Sound Effect.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is our invisible episode today. So, slime mold. It sounds gross, right? And if you see one in the woods, you're probably going to see why it got that gross-sounding name. They usually just look like a frothy ooze of mucus or something. But Angela Maley knows better, because she's seen them up close.
Under magnification, you can see a lot of them look kind of like little baked goods. A lot of them have sort of like a thin, like chocolatey covering encasing like a cookie interior. I think about dessert a lot while I'm drawing them. And then others are really extravagantly colored, iridescent, you know, like a butterfly. One of my favorite species looks a little bit like iridescent corn dogs on white sticks.
Maley's an artist and a museum studies person in Seattle, and she has glimpsed the invisible wonders inside the slime mold. And in fact, she's been kind of obsessed with these things for the last couple of years. So now she's designing a whole exhibit around the 400-year history of people like her who are fascinated with researching and drawing these gross-sounding organisms. I caught up with her in Seattle's Queen Anne neighborhood, where the house she's staying at is littered with drawings and models and cardboard cutouts of slime molds.
The first slime mold illustration was made in 1657 during like the reign of the British Empire in the late 1800s, early 1900s. They were being collected all over the world and drawn by lots of different people, and drawings and letters were being exchanged among slime mold enthusiasts.
Do you know why? What makes them special or different from other mold, or say a lichen, or just other kind of nondescript stuff that you might come across in the forest?
Well, their life cycle works like nothing else. So for a long time, people have wondered what exactly they were. They creep like animals in the first part of their life, and then they fruit like mushrooms. So a big part of the intrigue was just sorting out what exactly they were. In the first stage of their life, they are creeping and traveling and sending out sort of dendritic patterns, like the pattern of a river delta or a tree. And in that stage, they're just one cell, but sometimes they can be many, many feet long. And you might see that creeping along.
Oh, really?
Leaf litter, yeah.
Wait, many feet long, but one cell.
That's right, yeah. They have many, many nuclei encased in one long, blobby cell wall.
Whoa, I didn't know that. What would a completely lay person out for a walk in the woods looking down and seeing a slime mold see?
You might see dog vomit slime mold, one of the most common species, and that's kind of like a bright yellow blob that might be covering your mulch pile or something like that.
Gosh, why do they call it that?
Well, it looks a little bit a little bit gross to some people. I think it's pretty cool.
How did you get into slime molds? What awakened your curiosity about them?
I was studying mushrooms in North Florida, where I'm from, and I was going to school for art, and my most successful art projects came from just drawing what I found on the ground during my walks in the woods. And a lot of what I found was fungi, so I just became really interested in them. I got a microscope, and as I collected them, I started to see slime mold, so I started to learn about those things too.
Tell me a little bit about the exhibit that you're working on.
I've been working with slime molds for the last couple of years, illustrating a field guide to Australian slime molds for a guy that's famous for studying them. And I'm really interested in how nature gets portrayed differently throughout time. So depending on where you live in the world, what's going on in your society at the time, how your representation of something like slime molds turns out based on that.
So tell me more about some of the specifics of the exhibit. Like, who are some of these people from the 400-year history of slime moldology that are interesting to you?
Yeah, so there's Miss Lister, Julielma Lister. She was the head of the British Mycological Society in the early 1900s. And she lived in England with her father and her family. And she really made slime molds famous throughout the world. People were sending her specimens in boxes from Japan and India and all over the British Empire, and she drew every single one. She and her father were trying to make a book accounting for every known species.
Do you get any sense of what fired her up about slime molds? What it was that captivated her about them?
I actually have a quote. One quote is, "I cannot hope to convey an adequate idea of the charm these hunting grounds possess, nor how refreshing it is, after the eye has been long and intently searching close to the ground, to look up and survey the general landscape, which often includes a vision of dazzling snow peaks seen under the blue of the sky." So she kind of ties in an experience of searching for slime molds, but then looking up and remembering that they're part of this much huger landscape.
Okay, so we have Miss Lister, the poetic Victorian naturalist. Mm-hmm. Any other characters in this strange story?
Yeah, another one of my favorites is a Japanese guy, Minakata Kumagusu. When he turned 19, he sailed to San Francisco and then went to the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, studied mycology, and then to the Caribbean, and he joined a circus.
Do you know what he did in the circus?
Yeah, he drove an elephant.
So he was an elephant driver in the Caribbean circus in between scientific expeditions.
Right, yeah. And again, you know, you can find slime molds anywhere you go. So he was looking for slime molds and fungi all the way and collecting them, and then eventually took them all back home with him to Japan. He made a lot of illustrations of psychedelic mushrooms.
There is something psychedelic about the illustrations of slime molds, too, I have to say.
Some people tell me that. I'm just drawing what I see.
What are some of your other favorites?
This one's by Ross Tofinski. He's one of my favorites. He was a Polish guy. And he was the first person to ever draw the interior structures of slime molds, which was pretty important because up until that time, it was mid to late 1800s, people had only looked at the outside of them, but microscopes were getting better and better, so he had no excuse to not dissect them and delve further into them. So he draws all these really, those to me are the most, like, I don't know, I don't like to use the word trippy, but surreal, otherworldly illustrations.
So Angela, what's it like to build your early budding career around something that most people either don't think about, or if they do think about it, they think gross.
It's very satisfying. A couple summers ago, I got in trouble for letting kids in my summer camp class take home roly-polies. They wanted to take them home, and I gave them little Dixie cups, and then I guess their parents complained at the end of the day. And I knew that roly-polies were one of the most clean types of bug, so it was no problem. But experiences like that make me all the more adamant about portraying soil organisms and insects and slime molds as beautiful living things. And I think that's what all of these artists that I'm talking about have tried to do, have tried to convey how amazing they are and how they're just, yeah, another important element of the bigger world that we see around us every day.
Well, slime mold crusader Angela Mele is an artist, and she's designing an exhibit that's going to go in the library for the Center for Urban Horticulture at the Arboretum here in Seattle. When's that going to open?
September 10th, but you can come for my 30th birthday party, September 18th.
That sounds great. Thank you, Angela, for being on Sound Effect.
You're welcome. It was great. Thanks.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad, with production help from Matthew Strybe. Our intern is Bree Ripley. Jennifer Wing contributed to the show this week, and also thanks to Nancy Leeson. We get web help from Mike Lewis, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Please make your comments about the show visible. Leave us a review on iTunes, where you can also conveniently subscribe to our podcast. You can also write to soundeffect@kplu.org. or tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. Come on back next week when Sound Effect goes out after dark.
That's definitely the joke I made to my parents the first couple of times I did it, as in, hey, I'm attorney of the week. But no, you don't feel like you're winning something. You feel like if you're winning anything, you're winning probably some interrupted night's sleep.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.